The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. It's my pleasure to welcome back David Marinus. He's been called one of our most talented biographers and historians, and he is the author of the best-selling portraits of some of our country's most consequential figures, including Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, and Roberto Clemente. An associate editor at the Washington Post, he has twice won the Pulitzer Prize for journalism. His other honors include three additional Pulitzer Prize nominations, the Robert Kennedy Book Prize, the Anthony Lucas Book Prize, and the George Polk Award. In his latest bestseller, Path Lit by Lightning, he offers a nuanced and engrossing story of the life of Jim Thorpe, the man known as the world's greatest athlete, who, as a member of the Sac and Fox Nation in the early 20th century, faced some of his greatest challenges off the field of competition. Tonight, David will be in conversation with Paul Hendrickson, whose many books include Hemingway's Boat, a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, Sons of Mississippi, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, and The Living in the Dead, a National Book Award finalist. A feature writer at the Washington Post for two decades, he has been nominated six times for the Pulitzer Prize. You'll find an excerpt of his new book about his father, Fighting the Night, Iwo Jima, World War II, and a Flyer's Life in the Washington Post this coming Father's Day. Please welcome David Marinus and Paul Hendrickson.
I guess I'll go first. My little joke would be, you'll be forgiven if you think that we're at a National Boy Scout Jamboree at Valley Forge sitting around a campfire with the smoke getting in our eyes. I'm so pleased that as many of you came out that did tonight. That only speaks to the power and the prestige of this series. This is one of the great author series in America. It really is. And Andy Cahan, who just does this so superbly, week in, week out, all year long, and in this beautiful building. I've been privileged to be in this building a lot of times. I've been privileged to be in this audience at least three times by my memory that David Marinus, my esteemed friend from the Washington Post, was up here. Tonight, I get to be up here. It's my honor all the way. I was calculating this afternoon. I think David and I have known each other for 46 years. I think we started at the Washington Post together in 1977.
We got our 20-year pins the same night.
We did. That's how I know. And he said to me, "What are we doing here? You get a pin for this long. Something's wrong." But here he is at 46 years, still working for the Washington Post in one form or another as an associate editor. He's engaged in a monstrous piece right now, which I won't say anything about, but I've heard about it. I've always considered David the decathlete of the Washington Post, and we're talking about Jim Thorpe, the decathlete. But I'm toward the end here. If there's time, I might circle around and tell a decathlete Washington Post story about David Marinus. But I left after 23 years and came up to Philadelphia and Penn, and David stayed on, and here he is. Still doing Washington Post stories and still producing books like this. He doubles me up. For every one that I write, he writes two. Just have to accept that as one more little piece of humility whenever I'm sitting next to David. Oh, David, we can just jump in and go anywhere you want, but I guess it's kind of a broad question. What was it particularly that drew you to this subject and this man?
Well, first of all, thank you, Paul, and thank you all for coming out tonight. It means a lot. I was expecting to see my wife and maybe Paul and Andy, so this is really nice. It kind of started more than 20 years ago. I was in Denver at the Denver Press Club on a book tour for my book on Vietnam, They Marched in the Sunlight. And afterwards, a gentleman came up to me and identified himself as Norbert Hill of the Oneida Nation. And he handed me a sheaf of papers and said, David, I have your next book. And the papers were about Jim Thorpe. And I very politely said, as Paul, you're pretty much the same way, thank you very much. I don't take suggestions from anybody. It has to come organically from me. And I'm working on another book right now on Roberto Clemente, but thank you very much. And that was that. But Norbert Hill planted a seed. It just took a long time to grow. And the way it grew is that, you know, I have written about sports over the course of my being an author, but in each of the cases that I wrote about sports, it was to use sports, the dynamism of sports, the drama of sports to illuminate something larger about history and sociology. And so my first two biographies that could be called sports books, first Vince Lombardi. I grew up in Wisconsin with the glory years Packers, but that's not why I wrote that book. I'm not gonna write a book about Aaron Rodgers or Brett Favre or any of those jerk quarterbacks. But I wrote the book about Lombardi because I saw it as an opportunity to write about not just leadership, but about the mythology of competition and success in American life, what it takes and what it costs. Then Roberto Clemente, my second book. And as I recall, Paul, I was actually in your office at Penn when the first copy of that Clemente book came to me. Is that right?
I remember that moment and that day. He was sitting in my office at Penn, and he knew that he was going to be at Kelly Ryder's house that day. So the very first copy hot off the press, he had Simon & Schuster send it to the English department at Penn. And so I was there sitting in a chair. I mean, I've had this experience before, but I got to watch it all opening the package, yeah, and holding it in his hand. And I remember you called Linda, you called your wife, and you were describing the paper and the cenotaph at the front of the book. Yeah, I remember vividly that moment of the boy's thrill of opening. It never grows old, ladies and gentlemen. It never grows old.
It never does. In any case, you know, As I said, I grew up in Wisconsin with the Milwaukee Braves, right, of Henry Aaron and Warren Spahn. But Roberto Clemente was my favorite player, even as a kid. I thought he was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in his Pirates uniform. I just loved the way he threw the ball and walked and hit and everything about him, even the fact that he was called a hypochondriac. He really wasn't, but I am, so I identified with him in that sense. But again, that's not why I wrote this book. I wrote the book because so many athletes are called heroes and so few really are. But Clemente really was. I mean, his motto in life was, if you have a chance to help others and fail to do so, you're wasting your time on this earth. And he died trying to live out that motto, delivering humanitarian aid to Nicaragua after an earthquake in 1972.
Can I just jump in, yeah, right there on Clemente? I was in the audience because David spoke about Clemente and came to Penn, and I hosted him, but then he came to the Free Library maybe a month later or something. I was just privileged to sit in the audience. I remember something you said. In all his books, I think David is looking for something else. Of course, the subject, and as you penetrated as deeply as you can, but something else. And I remember sitting in the audience and hearing you say up here that you said Clemente was going the other way. You know, he's the great athlete out on the field, but he was going the other way to do this other thing. Mm-hmm. And he died doing, yes, it. And I mean, I think we can circle around to Thorpe on some of that, but I'm so pleased that you jumped into that story. And as far as the 20 years ago in Denver, I knew a little of that, but I love hearing that story again because books grow organically. Mm-hmm. My feeling is, and I, both of us, I think, that we don't find our subjects so much as they find us.
Yeah. And Thorpe eventually did find me. And again, so I started to think of a trilogy, and Jim Thorpe was the natural third part of that trilogy. A brilliant athlete, who did things that no athlete has done before or since, the trifecta of being a gold medalist in the decathlon and pentathlon, an All-American football player, the first great player in what would become the National Football League, the first president of what would become the National Football League, and a Major League Baseball player. No one has done all three of those things except Jim Thorpe. But that's not why I wrote
the book. That's not why he wrote it.
I wrote the book because I saw in Thorpe a chance to illuminate the Native American experience through his life, from 1887 when he was born to 1953 when he died, a very important era in the history of Native Americans.
I wonder if we can touch on this theme, and we've already hit some beautiful ideas tonight. As I read the book again in paper, I was struck again, David, by how much loss was in Jim Thorpe's life. I think that's one of your great themes in the book, isn't
Absolutely.
It? I mean, the loss of his people's lands. His twin brother Charlie in his childhood died at age 9. Thorpe's own son, his namesake son, at age 3 in the 1918 influenza. His medals, the loss of his medals, which is the story so many of us know. Money, stability, loss. And were you drawn to that?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I was not, sometimes when you're drawn to something, everything just sort of falls into place. So that the first loss you mentioned, the loss of land, started the year he was born. 1887 was a crucial year in the government's efforts to take away Native lands. It was that year that Congress passed the Dawes Act, which essentially was an effort to eliminate communal properties that Native peoples had had for centuries and try to turn them into white people by making them private land owners. In a rigged system where they lost millions of acres of their own property. That was the year Jim Thorpe was born. He was born in the Indian Territory of what would become Oklahoma. And shortly after that 1887 act came the Oklahoma land runs, you know, the famous land rushes of 1891 and 92, which were essentially white settlers taking Native lands. Jim Thorpe witnessed that as a little boy. The Boomers and Sooners, I don't know if there are any Oklahoma fans in this audience, but Boomer Sooner is basically a celebration of land thieves and their abettors. The land thieves were the Sooners who came in too early, even breaking the law to get to that property, and the Boomers were the rest of them. So that's what Jim Thorpe was born into, and then a progression of the losses that you articulated over the course of the rest of his life.
So this seems to me very important. Yes, this great theme of loss, but I think the triumph of the book is what David, and going somewhere else and always looking for something else, like the Clemente book, and Clemente was going somewhere else. David, rather, he chronicles the loss so poignantly, so heartbreakingly, but he doesn't leave it at loss. It is what comes next is the survival, right? That's the great. So it's the twin-headed theme of the loss, but out of the loss comes a man who just doesn't. David says, Jim Thorpe did not succumb. He did not vanish into whiteness. That's another element of this. But David, you saw, I think, more than any other Thorpe biographer, and there have been plenty, that out of this intense loss, which would have broken any of us, he did not give into it. He kept surviving, right? And that inspired you tremendously?
It did, and, you know, I was thinking a lot about, for instance, when I was writing the final 10 chapters of the book, I knew what was going to happen, but I kept rooting for something better to happen, right? Knowing that it wasn't going to. And so I was struggling with this notion of tragedy and what is tragedy and how the dominant society would define it versus the way a survivor would look at those same issues. And so I saw Jim Thorpe as a model of perseverance and, to the degree possible, a symbol of his people in that sense. And Paul, I write about a moment in around 1915 when the most popular statue in America was called the End of the Trail. And it depicted an Indian slumped on a stooped horse, and the connotation was that it's all over, that manifest destiny had prevailed, that the native race was dying and would soon be dead. And it was millions of people came to see this statue, and now it's replicated in Oklahoma and even Wausau, Wisconsin, and all over. But it didn't happen. Native peoples figured out how to survive, just as Jim Thorpe did. And so I started to think about that this is not a tragedy, even though there are a lot of tragic elements to it. It's a story of perseverance. And that really lifted the way I viewed Jim Thorpe and his story.
Because I think a lot of other writers would have just kept with the tragedy, with the downward trajectory. After all the greatness, it's the arc of his life seems to be the downward slope. And while David doesn't stent on that one bit and makes us feel it so acutely, so heartbreakingly, my real takeaway is the perseverance, the survivor. Your book, in some way, David, made me think all over again about Muhammad Ali. We know that man who had Parkinson's so badly, that image that's in our head, I think of him trying to, you know, carrying the torch mm-hmm. through Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's a great dignity there, isn't there? In all of this loss, there's a great dignity. And I see in Thorpe also, David, a humility. I'm thinking of when Branch Rickey in 1951 has his, you know, Branch Rickey was the guy who integrated baseball by bringing Jackie Robinson in. Branch Rickey was this great orator, and he went on and on and on at a testimonial dinner. And Thorpe is only 2 years from dying of a heart attack at this point. And he's the washed-up has-been. And so there's this great testimonial, and Thorpe gets up modestly at the end of it and gives a 55-word acceptance
if
speech?
That, yeah.
And gets $1,000. And then he says something like, well, I'm glad to see that I'm not a forgotten man after all. He doesn't seem to feel sorry for himself.
I don't think he ever felt sorry for himself. I think as he grew older, he started to feel more and more the pain of the injustices that were done to him. But that's different than feeling sorry for himself. I don't think he ever did. He had an equanimity about him in that sense that helped him persevere. And for those who don't know, I mean, what he went through, first of all, he struggled with alcoholism. He moved from state to state trying to get a job as a coach or find his way. There's a part in the middle of the book where I have a bunch of letters that he wrote to his second wife where he's, you know, he's almost a Willie Loman type of character at that point, thinking that the next thing is going to be it for him and he's going to finally figure out a way to survive, and it never happens. He lived in 20 different states. He took on all kinds of jobs, ranging from being a bouncer at a tavern to trying to run a youth program in Chicago, public summer program, to working in Hollywood for 10 years as an extra on a lot of movies, always just looking for that break that would never come his way. But he did not complain about it.
He worked with a pick and shovel in the
right.
Depression at an L.A. hospital site as a day laborer. Why? To support his family, right?
Yes, and you know, this is in the early 1930s. The Olympics are coming to Los Angeles in 1932, and Jim Thorpe isn't even invited. because he'd already been sort of scandalized by the loss of his medals from the 1912 Olympics, which is at the heart of the loss in the book. But he worked as a day laborer building a hospital in Los Angeles, among many other jobs.
Well, I was glad to see Jim Thorpe in that light of a man scrabbling to maintain his dignity with a certain humility long after his fame, because the fame is so just boggling of what he accomplished on the field. You summarized it so beautifully. No one ever did the things in the sports that he did. Would you talk just for a minute about Avery Brundage and Pop Warner? Until this book, I was naive. I thought Avery Brundage was the great exemplar of the purity of amateurism in sports. He was a bad guy, and David takes no prisoners with that. And Pop Warner as well. We think of Pop Warner, the great coach at the Carlisle Indian School, who developed Thorpe. Would you just talk a little about them?
They are two of the villains of the book. Pop Warner first, and then Avery Brundage for a long, long time. I never thought of Brundage as any exemplar of anything.
Except
a fat cat, a plutocrat, who would travel to fancy hotels in Europe, collecting East Asian art as he was preventing hardworking, working-class athletes from trying to make any money. You know, the whole notion of amateurism was founded by plutocrats, by rich Europeans who didn't need money, didn't need to get paid for their athletic endeavors. In any case, I think of Brundage, you know, as an older guy smoking cigars. He actually was a decathlete himself. He was at those 1912 Olympics with Jim Thorpe, competing against Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe was so much better, creamed Brundage, that Brundage quit after 8 events of the 10 events of the decathlon. This is the same Brundage who would say, you know, it's not important whether you win or lose or what country you represent, but just the nobility of the pursuit of athletics, is the pureness of it. And he couldn't take it when he was getting beat, so he quit. Then, as Jim Thorpe was moving on to professional sports and then the struggles of his later life, Avery Brundage was rising to become first the head of the American Olympic Committee, the U.S. Olympic Committee, and then the International Olympic Committee. And for all of that time, from the moment he started taking those jobs in the 1920s to the time Jim Thorpe died in 1953, all the way through the 1970s, Brundage refused to acknowledge that Jim Thorpe had been done an injustice in getting the medals taken away, which is a different story, which we'll get to. But that's Brundage. Now, that's just one of the many evils of Avery Brundage. The worst, Paul, by far, is his actions in 1936 when the Olympics were...
It cozies up to Nazism.
Yeah, absolutely. And made it sound like, you know, there was just American propaganda that was talking about the way Jews were being mistreated in Germany because he so much wanted those games to go on in Berlin. That's Brundage. Pop Warner, of the famed Pop Warner Youth Football, was a brilliant coach. He coached at Dartmouth, he coached at Carlisle, where Jim Thorpe rose to fame, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, which during Thorpe's era was the premier college football, not quite college, but they competed against colleges, football team in America. You know, it wasn't Alabama, Oklahoma, Penn State, your school, Ohio State, LSU that were great football powers then, but Yale and Army and Harvard and Penn.
And Penn.
Yes. Right. And Carlisle could beat them all. Pop Warner was the coach during that period. He was innovative. I love some of, you know, he was early and sort of promoting the forward pass, which had only recently been legalized, right, certainly before Thorpe got to Carlisle. He developed some trick plays that I wish they could do today. One was he'd have an end lineup on the side, near the sideline, go around the opposition bench, come out on the other side, and catch a pass. That was legal then, right? Or he threw a kangaroo pocket into the into the jersey of the center and hide the football in there. He also developed a lot of really good plays, but he was not a good human being. And the key to that is, again, we'll get into this deeper, but when Jim Thorpe's medals were taken away because he had played minor league, Bush League baseball for 2 summers in the Eastern Carolina League.
For $2 a day or something?
For $2 a day. Pop Warner, his coach, knew exactly what Jim Thorpe had been doing. He had been sending his Indian ball players to the minor leagues for years before that. The scout who brought Thorpe to Rocky Mount, North Carolina to play for the Rocky Mount Railroaders was Pop Warner's best buddy in Pennsylvania. But when the story broke, Pop Warner lied about it to save his own reputation, said he knew nothing that Jim Thorpe was doing. And then fast forward to near the end of Jim Thorpe's life. There's a movie. You don't mind if I go to this, do you?
No, go to the movie.
Okay, 1951, Jim Thorpe All-American, starring Burt Lancaster as Jim Thorpe. You know, a great movie star, a good actor, not a Native American, a good athlete. And the movie was sympathetic in many ways, but it was wrong in the most despicable way, which is the narrator of the movie is Pop Warner. And the implication is, if only Jim Thorpe had followed Pop Warner's advice and more successfully assimilated himself into white society, he wouldn't have had the troubles he had. The same Pop Warner who turned against him at the key moment of Jim Thorpe's life.
Yeah, that touches on this whole other notion, which is very powerful in the book. David quotes that pernicious sentiment, kill the Indian and save the man. That is, assimilation is supposedly the answer to the extermination. We can talk about that if you want
sure.
to right now.
Yeah. So the Carlisle Indian Industrial School was the main government boarding school for Native Americans. There were others, many others around the country, but it was the main government one, the flagship school. And it was founded in 1879 by a military man named Richard Henry Pratt, whose motto was, kill the Indian, save the man. Meaning the so-called Indian wars are about over, and now the only way that we can help Native people survive is to turn them into white people. That was the whole attempt of those boarding schools, the forced assimilation of Native kids. The first students there were Lakota Sioux, who had just been fighting Custer, you know, a few years earlier. And they were brought east to Carlisle. Their locks were shorn. They were taken away their Native clothing. They were told to not speak their Native tongue anymore, not to practice their religion. Everything about it was forced assimilation. Some of those kids thought they were going east to show their bravery and die. And sadly, many of them did die. And if you want to see something haunting, go up to the Army War College in Carlisle. And there's a cemetery there of hundreds of students who went there and died. It's still there. So that was the process of the school where Jim Thorpe rose to fame, which is, of course, a contradiction, as so many things are in history and life. You know, he became famous because of this school that was trying to forcibly assimilate him. And the other great irony of that school is that it became well known because of its great football team. And it was a huge attraction. If it played at Franklin Field against Penn, it would draw the largest crowd of the year to watch that game, because people wanted to see these exotic Indians playing for a school that was trying to eliminate that very part of them out of their system. Another great contradiction.
I want to get on the record here, and pretty soon we'll ask some questions to the audience, but I want to get on the record here that David is one of our great living biographers, and it's a little hard to pin it down. I mean, he's a great biographer of political figures. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. And then he pivots to sports figures, Clemente, Lombardi, Jim Thorpe. My take on this, David, is that, I mean, you hinted at it, or you said it really in the beginning, that these, all of these books, you're going for something more, I think, than the biography of the subject. They are windows into American culture, but I would almost like to think about them as windows into the American soul. And, you know, he's a biographer, but he's a historian. This great, great book about Vietnam, They Marched Into Sunlight, it's a rather genius idea. David is a Wisconsinite. He's a Madison boy. He's a University of Wisconsin boy. And you take one moment in the tragedy of Vietnam and try to find out what happened on a particular day in Vietnam to a group of soldiers and a protest going on at the same moment in David's hometown. A historian, a few years ago, David wrote a book about his own family. I guess a lot of you would know about that. A Good American Family. Boy, there's a window into the American soul. I know we're off Thorpe for a minute, but maybe we're not really. Would you just say something about that book?
Well, that book is about my father, who was suffered during the Red Scare. And I, you know, the motivation for that really came from the other biographies I'd written. You know, so when I was writing the biography of Barack Obama, I would find that things that he wrote about in his memoir, which is wonderfully written, were not accurate history. But he was passing along what he'd heard from his family about certain things. Like, he writes that his step-grandfather, Indonesian, because Barack's mother had married an Indonesian at one point, Lolo Sotoro, that Sotoro's father, Barack's step-grandfather, died heroically fighting for independence for Indonesia against the Dutch. And I discovered, in fact, he died of a heart attack falling off the ottoman in his living room trying to change the drapes. Not quite the same. But, you know, the right wing might jump on that and say, oh, Obama's a liar. You know, that's not the case at all. It was just he was passing along family lore. And I started to talk about that and think about it and think about my own family and the mythology in my family about my father, who had been a newspaper man in Detroit. The House Un-American Activities Committee came to Detroit. There was an informant who had been planted into the Communist Party in Michigan for many years before that. My father was named by her, and he was immediately fired from his job, and we bounced around for many years after that until he found his bearings. And that's the essence of this book. But there are many other elements to it. A Good American Family. My father fought in World War II. He was a captain of an all-black company in the Pacific, being called un-American by a committee chairman who was a Georgia racist, who not only that, but, you know, there's this wonderful musical on Broadway now called Parade, which is about the lynching of Leo Frank, the Jewish industrialist who was falsely accused of murdering a young woman. John Stevens Wood, the head of the House Un-American Activities Committee, as a young lawyer, drove the car that carried the lynched body of Leo Frank. He's calling my father un-American. So that's what that book is about.
I've read all of David's books, but that one, A Good American Family, David had no choice. He keeps himself, the first person does not appear in David's books. In that one, it had no choice but to appear. I love that book because he wrote about this good American family, and he wrote about how his father was the most loyal of Americans, really, rather than the most disloyal. And he had no choice but to write a lot of it first person, and it was a different David Marin showing himself on the
page. Paul was always urging me to write first person, so I know you said
Andy Cahan was signaling me. I hope at the very end of this I'll be able to tell my David Marinus decathlete Washington Post story, but we'll either get to that or we won't. Let's hear some questions from the audience right now.
Thanks. I wonder if you were ever daunted as you thought about starting a given book by the volume of biographies that might have already been on the market about whichever subject it was.
It's happened to me only once, and I didn't write the book. And that was, I was thinking of writing a biography of Paul Robeson. And the biography by Duberman is so terrific that I decided I can't add anything of value to that. That's the only time. But no, Lombardi, Clinton, Obama, Thorpe, nothing. I saw where I wanted to go, and nothing else was going to stop that. Thank you.
All right.
This is, can't wait to hear this question.
Have you ever, like, reconsidered making a book? Like, have you ever had an idea, but then, like, reconsidered making it something else?
Changing the book idea from one thing to the next. I would say that almost every book I've written has grown in ways that I didn't know it was going to grow or changed in some way, but the general idea was still the same. But I'm always open to where the reporting will take me. So sometimes it does, every time it changes some. And often the beauty of it is that it takes me places that I didn't know I was going to go, but it's better than what I thought. Paul had mentioned Branch Rickey before. His famous saying was, luck is the residue of design. And I feel I've been lucky many times in my research that led to these connections that I didn't know were there. But it's the residue of the hard work that takes you to that place. Thank you.
Jung, Carl Jung, the great psychoanalyst, had a line that he used to talk about and a whole idea of synchronicity, the phenomenon of luck based on desire. Mm. You know, David talks about his luck, but there's a great desire there to make something happen, a great will to make something happen. Luck, the phenomenon of luck based on desire. How about another question?
What was your most fertile, trustworthy resource for this book?
Thank you. So this book was different than any book I've done because for two reasons. One, Thorpe died in 1953. Nobody who knew him is around, basically. Even his grandchildren are mostly gone, so it was many generations removed. Secondly, it was during COVID. And my motto, as Paul knows, is go there, wherever there is, and in this case, I couldn't always go there. I couldn't get to Stockholm where he won his Olympic gold medals. We're finally going this August, too late, but still going. So the treasure troves for me were the Beinecke Archive and Library at Yale, which had all of the papers of the founder of the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, and some other fascinating papers, including those of the great native poet and novelist M. Scott Momaday, who was obsessed with Jim Thorpe. And I didn't know that until I just saw that his papers were there, and I started going into them, and there was all of this Thorpe material. He had even written an unpublished screenplay about Thorpe. So that was very helpful as well. Luckily, because Carlisle was a government school, all the records are there in the National Archives, and they were digitized. And boy, did that save a lot of time for me, you know, because I could just type in a name or an idea and get all of these records coming up. So that was another great resource. The University of Illinois has the papers of Avery Brundage, and the Cumberland County Historical Society in Pennsylvania, where Carlisle is, had a raft of material, including some many, many letters that they had purchased at an auction, which were very valuable for me. The National Museum of the American Indian had the papers of Grace Thorpe, one of his daughters, which also included many letters and other photographs and other documents. So those are some of the main resources. Interviews were not important in this case. It was all archival because he's so far into the past.
I was going to ask you about that when we were back and forth, that this was a pandemic book. All the more remarkable, the high achievement that this book is. David and I are all about the going there. He will immediately smile. Shirley Povich was the great sports writer, sports editor at the Washington Post. He worked at the Washington Post for 75 years. That's not a typo. He started as a copy boy. Do you know what he used to tell his young hires in the sports department? If you go, it'll happen.
If I may, I have two questions.
Sure.
David, how has your work as a reporter working for the Washington Post informed and influenced your work as a biographer?
Well, I mean, I think it's everything for me. I mean, I learned how to do research by being a journalist and a newspaper guy for decades. I developed instincts about where to go for material, who to trust, how to balance off and triangulate information through that. I had always, you know, Paul says I've been at the Post for 47 years. The truth is I'm never there. That's how I survive. And it's because I've always tried to find my own way. And that also is the way I approach books. You know, look for what's not there. Do it your own way. Don't follow the crowd. That was my tendency as a newspaper person, and it is in books as well. Actually, another thing that influenced my writing was not newspapers, but radio. My first job was for WIBA Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, as a kid. And rather than just rip the wires and read the news, I would rewrite it. And I learned how to write in a way that had a rhythm to it. It's not the length of the sentence, it's the rhythm of the sentence. And if you read it out loud, you understand that. And that's helped the rhythm of my writing as well.
I never knew that story. I love it.
My second question is the name Thorpe.
Yes.
Was that the name he was born with, or did it evolve in some
other way? He was born, his dad was Hiram Thorpe. Hiram spelled it without an E, although in that era, the spelling of surnames was always up for grabs. But yes, his father was part English, part mostly Sac and Fox and some other elements to it as well. But that was the family name for a few generations going back, yes.
So going back to what you're saying about reading out loud, I first encountered this book as an audiobook, and I just want to say your reading of your words, you brought so much emotion, particularly in those last 10 chapters, and you know, thinking about when you were reading, I remember exactly where I was in tears and could feel the emotion in your voice as you were talking about him as an uncredited
actor. You sure it wasn't
actor.
My pathetic, asthmatic wheezing?
I had to say, I actually went back and looked at some of your, started downloading some of the other books, but only where you were reading as the author. So I just want to pay you that odd compliment. You said at the outset tonight about Clemente, and I just want to get the words right. You said, so many athletes are called heroes, but so few are.
Yes.
Was Jim Thorpe a hero?
In a different way. And I think the important way, the most important way that Jim Thorpe is a hero is to his people. In the course of traveling after this book came out, I've been interviewed by a lot of Native American activists and scholars. I've gone to a reservation. And the importance of Jim Thorpe to the, you know, there's even a rapper named Tall Paul who does this wonderful rap on Jim Thorpe. I recommend it to anybody. So, yes, in that sense, he is. He means a lot because of his accomplishments. I think there's less of an understanding of everything else he endured, but because Native peoples have endured so much, they understand that, of course, you know, that's a given.
Could you comment about the town in Pennsylvania that was renamed?
Oh. Thanks for asking that. What a bizarre story. I'm sure some of you have been to Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, you know, and it's an antique-y town now and all that. crazy. So when Jim Thorpe died, his third wife, Patsy Thorpe, Jim Thorpe died in Los Angeles of a heart attack at age 65. His body was taken back to Oklahoma. The Sac and Fox people were in the middle of a burial ceremony when Patsy interrupted it and took his body away because she was upset that Oklahoma was not going to build this grand mausoleum that she wanted. So then she essentially put him up for bids, took him to Tulsa, offered him to Carlisle. She was in Philadelphia here at a hotel meeting with Bert Bell, the commissioner of the National Football League. And she was watching television and saw this report about these two down-in-their-luck towns in the coal country of the Poconos, Mauch Chunk and East Mauch Chunk, Pennsylvania, and how they were trying to raise money for an economic development plan. And she, and of course, it's a beautiful country. And so she came up with this scheme. And I compare her to Harold Hill and the Music Man. She went up there and said, look, if you merge and change your name to Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, I'll give you Jim Thorpe. And I will also build a Jim Thorpe hospital. We'll have a Jim Thorpe college. I'll even build a teepee hotel up here. And I'll help you with your economic development. And maybe we'll even get the Pro Football Hall of Fame to locate here. They bought it. So they changed. They voted to merge, changed their names to Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. And he's buried there. There's a mausoleum on the side of the road in a place that he'd never set foot in his entire life. He wanted to be buried in Oklahoma. His sons, after a few years of frustration, took it to court to try to get him removed back to Oklahoma using the, I forget the exact title of the Congressional Act, but it has to do with museums and artifacts and so on that should go back to their native places. And they won the first federal court, and it was lost on appeal on the basis that Patsy, his wife, had the power to decide, and this wasn't a museum, and so it didn't apply. And the Supreme Court didn't take it up, so he's up there. And you know, I have absolutely nothing against the people of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, but I think morally, ethically, he belongs where he wants to be, you know, with his native people, the Sac and Fox in Oklahoma.
You can only laugh at that story so that you don't cry at that story.
I hardly know where to begin. When an author is as accomplished as you are, they're usually in one mold or the other. They write political books or they write sports books. Or I'm still astounded that this is one person who has done all these books. I'm not done. And then because of you, I've just recently discovered audiobooks. So because of you, I have to get this. I had no idea you read it. So I have a question for you,
right,
and one for you, Paul. Right. For you, I'm wondering, what are you working on now, or what are you working on next, or are you just resting on your laurels, which I doubt? And for you, I want to hear that story that you've been waiting to tell.
Oh, okay.
So in answer to the question you didn't ask, I don't consider my books political or sports. They're just books, you know? I mean, I approach them the same way. One of my sort of mentors, or someone who was very generous to me, was David Alperstam. And he would sort of move back and forth, but he would disparage his sports books and say he wanted to go to the toy department for a while. I never looked at it that way. And I think politics can be very trivial, and sports can be sociologically meaningful. It depends on how you approach any of them. And so I approach them all the same way. Right now, my wife would tell you that I'm taking a gap year. Oh, no, she'd tell you, nice try, because I'm actually still working. But I'm doing, Paul alluded to it, I'm working on a big piece for the Washington Post with my wonderful colleague, Sally Jenkins, who's a great sports columnist. I'll just tell you this much. last November, we did a big piece about Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, which showed that it was about race in the NFL, and we found photographs of him as a youngster standing in front of the schoolhouse door in Little Rock to prevent black kids from desegregating the school. So we enjoyed working together. Jerry Jones, JJ, we decided we'd do another story, and it's about another person whose initials are JJ.
You'll just have to wait to find out what it's about. Now, I'm not saying, and he's not saying, but you want to hear my David Marinus decathlete Washington Post story, don't you? And I see that we're about out of time. This will wrap this up, I think. David has heard me tell this story before. I've embarrassed him before with this story. Why not once more? 9/11, September 11th, 2001. It was a Tuesday in America, wasn't it? I had left the Washington Post by then. We'd started together in 1977. We came from different places. I was up here at Penn at that point, but I was only recently out of the Post, so I had a lot of friends and heard a lot of inside stories. So 9/11 happens. And as we all know, because we all lived through it, millions and millions of words got written across the world and across the United States within the second day, the third day, the fourth day, the fifth day. But now it's coming the weekend, and the way a big weekend Sunday piece will happen in your flagship newspaper, the New York Times is going to do it, the LA Times is going to do it, what is the Washington Post going to do on Sunday, 6 days after 9/11? Well, David was tapped to hold the flag up and write the story as all of us are coping and with this chaos and still trying to make sense of it. And what he did, I mean, I wasn't there, but I've made the myth of it myself, is that reports were funneling in from correspondents from the Washington Post all over America about what was happening here and what was happening there and what the grief was here in this family in Kansas and Chicago. And David, in one gigantic marathon writing situation, started a Friday night or something, because it had to be in by the Sunday paper?
I started at 6 o'clock Friday morning and finished it at 6 o'clock Friday night.
Say that again. 6 o'clock Friday morning. Finished at 6 o'clock. And copy aides are feeding him sandwiches as he's padding around the newsroom in his socks trying to get the next paragraph.
True.
Go ahead. Is it true?
Yeah, that part's true. Tuna fish sandwich.
There were about 800 editorial staff in the Washington Post. David was picked to do this assignment. That's the Jim Thorpe of the Washington Post, the decathlete of the Washington Post. Thank you all so much for coming tonight.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.